Very good. So, meditation. First of all, you may have heard me say earlier on in this retreat, there are two different types of meditation. And the usual answer is samatha vipassana, and I say, no, don't sort of start to say that, because that's not correct. According to my teacher, according to how I understand the teachings of the Buddha. And so I used to say instead, the two types of meditation, which is far more practical, is the Second Noble Truth Meditation and Third Noble Truth Meditation. Just reminding you of that. The Second Noble Truth, wanting leads to suffering. Third Noble Truth, letting go of wanting, leads to nibbana, leads to the highest happiness. So far on this retreat, are you suffering? Are you frustrated? Are you disappointed? Did it not live up to your expectations so far? If so, why? Come on, put some more effort into it. Sit longer. Do more. Try that, and what happens? More suffering. Because wanting is the cause for suffering. Second Noble Truth. And the Third Noble Truth, letting go of that wanting, that craving, that desire, letting that go is a cause for nibbana, freedom, happiness. So if you're having some good meditations, if the meditation is peaceful and joyful, why? Because you let go. You renounce, you stop the craving. Somehow or other, you just like that novice last night, when am I going to stop? And you stop. And this is what happens. So sometimes when you look at the teachings of the Buddha, sometimes we go into the very refined teachings and forget the basic teachings. And the basic teachings are by far the most powerful. But when it gets to samatha and vipassana, that people have been arguing about that for so many lifetimes. You know, should you do samatha first and then vipassana? Is vipassana different than samatha? Is samatha really necessary? What is vipassana anyway? And I think I already mentioned to you that Ajahn Chah's simile, the front of the hand and the back of the hand, you cannot split the front from the back. So you may think that samatha is going first, vipassana always comes behind. Vipassana first, samatha is always coming behind. Because the whole job of samatha, calm, what are you trying to calm down? What are you trying to settle down? It's not just the five senses, it's also those five hindrances. To calm them down, settle them down. Because that's what stops you getting insight. You don't see what's really there. Instead, you see what you want to see. Or you don't want to see what is too hard for you to see. So what happens is that after a while, that you realize that calming the mind down, overcoming those hindrances, is also how you practice vipassana. And the two always go together. But anyway, my simile of samatha vipassana was, those of you who haven't heard it before, this was the couple. They weren't married, they were just living together. Sam and Vi. Short for Sam Atta and Vi Passana. So Sam and Vi were a very happy couple. They'd always go everywhere together. So one afternoon after lunch, they decided to go up and have a lovely walk up Meditation Mountain. And Sam wanted to go up Meditation Mountain because it was so peaceful and calm up in Meditation Mountain. It was so noisy where he lived. And Vi, she wanted to go up there because it had incredible views, and she took her camera, not one of these little iPhones, but really professional, Canon extra professional, whatever it was. And it was really took incredible photos. And up there, how you got up Meditation Mountain, oh, you could see forever up there. So she went up there for taking a camera for the view. He went up there for the peace. But they also had two dogs with them. So the big dog was Metta, Metta the dog, and the little dog was Anapana. And why did dogs go for a walk? They are so much wiser. They don't think it out. No, I should do vipassana. How do I do vipassana? How do you do samatha? Should you focus on the tip of the nose, or where should you focus? Dogs are much wiser. They just walk for fun. So what was that piece of doggy wisdom? I don't know if I told it to you already. From Snoopy the dog. Because this year in the Chinese calendar, it's a year of the dog. And so because it's a year of the dog, you focus on dogs and their great wisdom. And one of those was the great quote from Snoopy the dog. Because Charlie Brown and his dog Snoopy were discussing the meaning of life, as dogs usually love doing. And Snoopy said, you know, that we must all die one day. And can you argue with that? Can you find fault with that? We'd all die one day. And you think, well, you know, you can't argue with that, but think again. Because inside is not saying what other people say or just believing what they say. He's actually seeing it from a different angle. As I mentioned yesterday, that's what insight is. So not when is Ajahn Chah going to stop, when am I going to stop? Everyone must die one day. And Snoopy replied, yes, but most days we don't die. And that was incredible wisdom. You know, why did I see that? Because when you think, yeah, we're all going to die one day, sort of, you know, makes you a bit depressed. But when most days you don't die, that's still being truthful, and it's true in your life, more days than not, you're not going to die. So that gives a bit of positivity without sort of ignoring the truth of death. You realize that most days you won't die. So that type of wisdom, that's why I just really sometimes you like dogs. And what was that other story which there was this lady, she came back late at night. I think I told this the last Friday night talk I gave in Nolamara. She came back late one afternoon, she'd been done her shopping, you know, had her hands full of shopping bags and managed to get the key out and kick the door open, and then, because she couldn't sort of had her hands free. And as she was opening the door, this big dog ran past her into her house. She didn't see this dog before, didn't know what it was, why it was coming to her house, but she couldn't stop it, she had her hands full of shopping. So she put the shopping bags on the kitchen table and went to find out, you know, what this dog was doing, and found out this dog, it was a Labrador, and it was just beautifully curled up in the corner of her house, already fast asleep. And it wasn't so creating, it was, you know, clean, it wasn't a stray dog, it had a collar on it. And it was, you know, just a very lovely dog, well kept. And so she saw it sleeping there peacefully, she said, oh, why not, you can sleep there. So she let the dog have a sleep and put her sort of groceries away. And a couple of hours later, the dog woke up and she let it out of the house and it went away. And it was really weird, sort of dogs coming and staying in her house, but it was a beautiful dog. But it came back the next day and came into her house, sat in a nice corner, went to sleep. 2 hours later, woke up and she let it out again. And this went on for about 4 or 5 days in a row. And she was wondering, what the heck is this dog coming to my house for? So she was a very smart lady. She got a piece of paper and wrote a note on a piece of paper. Said, this dog has been coming to my house every afternoon for a couple of hours. I don't mind, he's a very clean and wonderful dog, I like dogs. And he just sleeps in the corner and then gets up and I let him out. I've never seen him before, I don't know where he lives, but he's obviously got an owner. I just want to know, just why? And of course, the next day when the dog came back, and he tucked it under the collar, you know, like dog post. And the next day the dog came back, And she saw it had a different note in it, the reply. So the little dog went to go sleep in a corner, and she opened up the piece of paper, and it said, "The dog belongs to me. It's just a couple of blocks from here. And in my house, we've got a very stressful family. The wife is, you know, always having to do all sorts of stuff. We've got about 5 or 6 kids, 2 under 5, and they're always messing around with the dog. And the dog is obviously coming to your house to get a peace and quiet, bit of peace and quiet." Sign the husband. And then, P.S., can I come along too? That's dogs in modern life. So it's only a matter of time before a couple of dogs come into here when they're going on retreat. It actually almost happened. Because, what was it, a couple of years ago, a cat came to Bodhinyana Monastery, just at the start of the rains retreat. It was a beautiful cat, and very fluffy. And it was obviously, it wasn't a stray, because, you know, it just came up to the monks, and obviously the monks are very easy to get on with and just get so much milk and fish or whatever else we can find for this little cat. And anyway, it's just a very friendly cat. And because during the rains retreat we don't do very much, sort of, you know, we just let it hang around, and afterwards we thought, well, we've got to do something with this cat, because according to law, the cats have to be registered, and they have to have a little chip put in their body, so that it can be registered. And if it gets lost, then people can find it. So we took it to the local vet, and the vet said, it's already got a chip in, and its name is George, and it comes from South Perth, which is about 60 kilometres from here. So he rang up the owner, and the owner said, "Yeah, I wonder what happened to George. He went missing just at the start of the rains retreat." And I thought, obviously that was a Buddhist cat who came to Bodhinyana Monastery for the 3 months meditation retreat. And how it came all the way from South Perth to here, I haven't got a clue. And why it decided to adopt us, but it did adopt us. It's obviously a Buddhist in its previous life and just wanted to do a meditation retreat. And did very well. It did suffer a bit from sloth and torpor, as cats usually do. Always sleeping anywhere. But anyway, also back to the Sam and Atta and Metta and Anapana, the dogs. So they went up Meditation Mountain, and when they got only halfway up Meditation Mountain, oh, it was so peaceful. So Sam was already just enjoying the incredible peace and stillness. It was lovely up there. And Vi, she was taking these amazing shots. Even halfway up, you could see so far into the universe, into the meaning of things. And as for Metta, the dog, oh, she was wagging her tail. And Anapana Sati, the breath, you could hardly find her. She was vanishing. And when they got to the top of Meditation Mountain, it was incredibly still. So Sam was just, whoa, so much piti sukha, so much joy, so much happiness up on top of Meditation Mountain. And Vi, she was taking these amazing insight shots. Unbelievable what you could see up there. And as for Metta the dog, I know what it's like when a dog is really, 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 really happy. They run around in circles, wagging their tail like it's going to fall off. Metta was just so blissed out. Anapana, no, couldn't find that dog anywhere. But also on top of Meditation Mountain, Sam had a pair of eyes, and so did Metta the dog. They were also enjoying the view. Vi, could appreciate, even though she was taking photographs, she could pause to appreciate the incredible stillness. And Metta, the amount of love and joy and compassion on top of Meditation Mountain was out of this world. Because the meaning of that simile is that stillness, insight, and joy coexist on the top of Meditation Mountain. That's the truth of the matter. So sometimes people say, oh, it's either Sam or Vi. Don't forget metta. It's not just stillness, no samadhi, or just insight. The three of them always come together. And of those three, sometimes, you know, the joy, the happiness, the metta, sometimes that is forgotten, which means it's not real samatha, it's not real vipassana. What's the point of vipassana if you see things as they truly are and you're a miserable pile of gomayang? Something wrong there. So the point of the matter is that you can tell how much peace you have, how still, how deep in meditation you are, from the joy, as well as the insights which come up afterwards. You can tell how well your vipassana, your insight practice is going, by how peaceful you are, how still, and how much joy you have in your life. You can tell also how your metta practice is going, by how much peace and how much wisdom comes. They all go together. So because of that, you don't think, oh, what should I do next? Should I do some vipassana? Should I do some samatha? Should I do some metta? Should I do so much and then switch to this or switch to that? You don't switch to anything, because this is all becomes a totally natural process. So you get insight as you, even like, okay, you may think I've been focusing on samatha, calming the mind out, going to the breath, calming the breath, allowing the body to vanish, beautiful lights in the mind, settling them down, getting into the nimittas, the jhanas, where things start to disappear and you realize amazing truths. And you say, well, so what? So what? It's because you experience some of those things. Even the delightful breath you need insight and wisdom just to get there. And you get so much wisdom as a result. And you become so much happier. You need wisdom to be able to get their insight, just to get to say delightful breath, to be able to know how to watch the breath. And how you watch the breath, and I've been teaching that the last few days, is you're sitting down comfortably, you don't force the mind. You know, if the mind sort of says, no, I don't feel like it today, great, take it for a cup of tea. And you don't treat the mind or the breath like a slave. Right. Breathe in, now, out, now. Sometimes I have a bit of fun with that, because sometimes people think watching the breath is boring. So, just messing around with perceptions. I'm going to give you a little exercise now. Come, close your eyes, breathe in and out three times. And at the end of the third breath, open your eyes. But remember, carry on breathing afterwards. The end of the third breath, open your eyes. So now, you all managed to do that. Some people have still got their eyes closed, which means they don't know how to count. So now, we're going to make it a little bit different. So when I say go, I want you to close your eyes and breathe out first and then in. Breathe out, then in. Out, then in. So this time you're going to start with the out-breath. Okay, when you're ready, go. And then open your eyes. And you'll find, strange as it may seem, that it's totally different. you begin with an out, we always tend to begin with in-breaths, in-out, in-out. So just be a bit weird. Think outside the box. Live on the wild side, as David Bowie used to say. Out first, and then in. It actually feels different. It's weird, isn't it? But I call that the backwards breath meditation. Never heard in this Buddhist cycle until now. Without first, it is actually different. And if that doesn't work to make it interesting for you, you do the 3 in-breaths to 1 out-breath. Have you ever heard that on any other retreats? You see, this is but what it really is doing, it's just, why do we always do things in one way? And just we don't challenge accepted wisdom. Why is it we limit our insight practice? Just to do it the way you've been taught. Why not try something a little bit different? So you try things like that, and you find, my goodness, it works. So you do need, sometimes, you sit in there just to watch the breath. How can I manage to watch the breath? My own history of meditation. First meditation was to watch the breath at the tip of the nose. I have hay fever. Like many of you, you are sneezing. It's mostly hay fever, not colds. So sometimes your nose was blocked up. I couldn't watch it at the tip of my nose. Nothing was happening there. So, you know, it was coming in and out through my mouth. So then it came along, you can watch the breath at your belly, rise and fall, rise and fall. And that would work for a while, until I became a monk, and then you didn't eat in the afternoon, and this was so close to your stomach. So I was watching my belly, and it just went just a few inches higher than it was in my stomach. I was hungry, I wanted something to eat. I was a young man, I was thin, I needed my energy. So that didn't. Every time I tried to watch my belly, it started to become hungry. So that wasn't working. And then, of course, you know, insight. What did the Buddha actually say? He never taught nose meditation, nor belly meditation. Taught breath meditation. Watch the breath. So, you know, when you know you got into difficult situations because you didn't know what to do, you started thinking, well, watch my breath. That's what you need to do. So, am I breathing in, am I breathing out? I was always doing one of those. So how do I know? When I asked myself, how do I know I'm breathing in or breathing out? I could always answer the question. And it was a sensation, a feeling, some information, some data I was being received by my brain to tell me, yes, you're breathing in right now. And I decided that's what I'm going to watch. Not the tip of the nose, I'm not watching my nose, I'm not watching my belly, I'm watching my breath. That feeling, sensation, information, whatever it was, which told me what my breath was doing. And that became so much easier. Because sometimes my breath wasn't at the tip of the nose, sometimes it wasn't at the belly, but it was always happening somewhere. So I decided not to choose where I'm going to watch the breath. Wherever the breath was, that's what I watch. And that became so much easier. So all the time I can watch the breath. And number two, you got the insight, is sometimes I treated the breath like a slave. Right, breath, you stay here. Okay, I'm going to watch you. Breathing in, breathing out. And sometimes the breath will mess around, it will stop breathing for a little while. What should I do now? So I decided to, after a while, because I was treating my breath like a slave, telling it what to do, sometimes the long breath or the short breath, breathe in long. How long? Never really said, did it? So I tried it really long. Come on, let's do it the longest breath. Guinness Book of Records length. Breathing in. Really uncomfortable. Or the short breath, really short. And it was ridiculous. And it also created so much tightness and tension in me. So after a while, just, well, it doesn't matter if it's long or short. And you know, most of the time it was in between somewhere. It wasn't a long breath, it wasn't a short breath, it was just breath. And then suddenly you began to realize, look, it doesn't really matter, long or short. You don't have to fake it and make it long or make it short. Just know, roughly what type of breath it is. That's all. But even then, sometimes, you know, it's a good old my predecessor, Ajahn Chakra. He said, Ajahn Bhav, you're really good at meditation, but you should spend more time teaching others how to do that beginning stuff, how to even get to the breath. I thank him for that, because that was really nice what he said. Because why is it we can't get the breath? We struggle for it because we don't prepare. You ask any builder, any painter, before you paint a wall, you've got to sort of sand it, clean it, get rid of all of the oily, greasy stuff by using, what's it called? Something, saddle soap or whatever it is. Oh, not saddle soap. Sorry? Sugar soap, that's right, yeah. Sugar soap, just to sort of get it ready for painting. And preparation is, you know, maybe 60-70% of the work. So once it's all prepared, a professional painter will do it really quickly and make a good job, because they spend most time in preparation. So the insight came up that, well, why don't I do the same when I'm before I watch the breath? So I made sure that I was really comfortable. So, you know, I was not too much food, not too little food, nice cup of tea or coffee or whatever you like. Get yourself really comfortable. And my body said, yep, okay, you looked after me. Just like when you before you go on a journey in a car, you make sure there's enough petrol, there's enough oil, there's enough whatever else, gas or whatever. You got some water there, especially if it's in Australia, if it's a difficult hot day. You're all prepared, and then off you go. Preparation. And so once I prepared, make sure everything was nice, then off you went, relaxing your body first of all. And my body really needed to be relaxed to get into deep meditation, because otherwise you go looking for the breath too soon and the knee hurts. So stop it, knee. I'm watching my breath. And that just make it more upset. It was like different parts of my body were throwing a tantrum. Hey, you're ignoring me. Yeah, I'm watching your breath, okay, shut up. Nose wanting to sneeze. Stop it, nose. I'm about to get enlightened, okay, so you just be quiet. Deal with you later. Sometimes you deal with the body like that, and of course the body sort of throws a tantrum. So I'll make sure every part of the body is really good. And then I start to watch my breath. Actually, don't really watch my breath, I just relax. Relax the body. And the other preparation was letting go of the past and the future and learning how to be still. Got to the insights. How do you let go of the past and future? And I gave you a very powerful insight in how to let go of the past and the future is be kind to the past, be kind to the future. Because if you hate the past, if you're averse to the future, in other words, you have anxiety and fear, it makes it stronger. So the insight, which I haven't mentioned yet, surprisingly, but this insight is just amazing insight, which is in the suttas, but never emphasized enough. The old anger-eating monster simile. And that anger-eating monster, that was where the empress, she was away one day. She was obviously on a meditation retreat in Jhana Grove. And in her palace came this huge, ugly monster. It was big, terrifying, violent. Ugh. You know, for some reason I like doing that. Maybe I need some more practice being frightened. Am I frightening at all? Never. Maybe I'm out of practice for too many lifetimes. But anyway, really terrifying monster. Now, in all palaces, they have security, and they have guards, and they have soldiers. But this monster was so frightening that even the security were afraid. And so some of them, they hid in the broom cupboards. Some went under the tables, some behind the flower pots, anywhere to hide from this really frightening monster, allowing this monster to go right into the center of the palace, into the throne room, and sit on the empress's chair. And that was just one step too far. The guards came out, "Who do you think you are? That's our empress's chair. Out, now!" But those few unkind words, unkind deeds, unkind thoughts, the monster just grew an inch bigger, and more ugly, and more frightening, and more smelly. And that really upset everybody in the palace. "Get out, threatened him, say we're going to sort of blow you up, we're going to sort of cut you to ribbons with our swords, we're going to machine gun you," whatever it was. Actually, they never had machine guns in the time of the Buddha, but you know what I'm talking about. So every unkind word, unkind deed, unkind thought, the monster just got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and more frightening, and more violent, and more stinky, until by the time the empress came back, this monster was absolutely gigantic and so frightening, so scary. That, what was it, the scariest monster was supposed to be alien? In the Alien Monsters, I've never seen Alien, but is that scary? What's the scariest monster you've ever seen? No, Donald Trump when he's angry? Kim Jong-un? Kim Jong-un with a anti-ballistic missile? I don't know. Who's the most angry person? Anyway, just really really angry, very frightening. And the smell, the stench coming off this monster was so bad that even the maggots crawling on his skin threw up, they vomited. Even maggots couldn't stand the smell of this monster. And the empress saw that monster. She knew what to do. That's why she was the empress. She was the smartest of them all. And so she looked and said, "Welcome. Thank you, monster, for dropping by. Why have you waited so long just to pay me a visit? Has anyone got you a cup of tea yet? We have many different types of tea. We have Sri Lankan, Duma with condensed milk, Tinkiri. We have peppermint tea. We have green tea. We have, what would you like? And then, have you had anything to eat yet? Would you like a pizza?" Why pizza? Because it comes in monster size. So, I mean, she was seriously, legitimately kind to this monster. And the monster started to shrink, get less smelly, less ugly, less frightening. And then all the people they worked in the palace, the soldiers, the guards, they figured it out. They got insight. "We've been given this monster ill will and anger." So now they decided to try kindness. So a few of the soldiers, they went around the monster, got one of his feet and gave him a foot massage. Reflexology. It's very rare that such a monster could get his huge feet massaged. And so it was just such a wonderful, oh, just there, oh, that's nice, oh, thank you so much. Some gave him a shoulder massage. Because if you've seen these monsters, they've got these huge heads. Imagine just the stress on their neck muscles with such a huge head. And the tightness inside being mean and nasty because having to fulfill what people expect of you. And living up to other people's expectations, like you asked me the other day, trying to please other people by being nasty, because that's what we expect of a monster these days. And so the tightness and the stress, so they gave him a massage, oh, that was really good. And every kind act, kind deed, sorry, kind word, kind thought, the monster kept on shrinking and shrinking and shrinking, until the monster became the same size as when it first came in. But they carried on with the kindness, carried on with the compassion, until the monster got that small one more act of kindness, and vanished completely away. And the Buddha called that the anger-eating monster. So, that was actually in the Devaputta Sanghita, appeared in Sakya's palace in the heavenly realms. But the main part of the story is, as I said it, there wasn't foot massages or pizzas or anything, but you know, the main idea is exactly the same. Kindness. So that's an insight we get. Trial and error, mindfulness gives us feedback. We realize if we treat the monsters in our mind with anger, get out of here, you don't belong. The past, get out of here, you don't belong. I want to get rid of my past. I want to obliterate it. That's why they open the door of your heart to the people with trauma. That's why it works. Come in, not get out. Fear the future. Be kind, compassionate to your future. And then you find the monsters of the future, they shrink until they go. Not because you chase them out, but because of kindness. So, that's the insight, how you let go and become in the present moment. When you're with the present moment, again, be kind to the present moment. Don't say it's not good enough, I want to get it better. Just, you're here. It's not that bad. I mean, if you can't be content in Jhana Grove, where you haven't, you know, your boss, if you call me the boss, you know, I'm not just telling you what to do and how to do it and do it now. Okay, what have you achieved so far? Come on, do a report for me. You don't have that pressure here. And the food manager said last night, Bianca, the deva, now, what better place can you have here? And so if you can't be happy here, where can you be happy? So you just say, oh, this is good enough for me. So you enjoy this place, and then you find you're kind to this moment. And that's when the breath starts coming up. You are learning insight on how to just be with the breath. You're learning with insight just how the joy starts coming up. And how that joy starts coming up is, keep on saying, it's when you don't do anything, you're just being here, not really judging, being kind to this moment, you find you get happier and happier and happier. The energy, instead of going to the doing, struggling, striving all over the place, it goes into just knowing. You wake up. And that's, you understand what the Pali means of the Buddha. Ujjati, you're waking up. You're being here. You're being sati, mindful. And with it would always come, if you practice it properly, the joy and happiness, the power. It's not just mindfulness. Everyone is aware to a certain amount, but is that awareness with the joy and the happiness and the power? Power mindfulness, superpower mindfulness, I called it. So it just happens if you start letting go and becoming still and peaceful, you become happy. What is happiness? The great insight. Happiness, everyone wants to be happy, but a lot of people don't know what it is. That's why we keep becoming unhappy. Sometimes happiness is a nice plate of your favorite food. Is that happiness? Happiness is falling in love. Happiness is a good friend. Happiness is, what is happiness? So, you use insight to get one of the greatest pieces of wisdom. What is happiness? And happiness is what's there when you're not wanting anything. Remember, that one of the best explanations of what happiness is that cartoon in the kitchen. I want happiness. First mistake, I. It is still there, isn't it? Yeah. take off the I. That's first error. Second error, want. And what are you left with? Happiness, yay! The problem is I and want. When those two go, there's happiness. Try it. So, these are powerful insights. Sometimes they ask me, as a monk, I've been a monk over 44 years now, and he said, don't you miss anything? And I start thinking, no. Don't you miss having children? And no. Don't you miss sex? No. Why do you want those things for when you've got something richer and more powerful? So a lot of the times, sometimes when you know what happiness is, if it's happiness which depends upon others, your children, your family, your loved ones, every now and again, one of your loved ones dies. Unexpectedly? I don't know why people think it's unexpected. If you are a real Buddhist and understand the nature of things, if you get a call from Singapore that your mother's died last night, say, I expected that. What do you mean? She was in perfect health. Being in perfect health today doesn't mean you can't die tomorrow. I expected people could die at any time. Fortunately, I haven't had the nerve to do that. Sometimes when people say, oh, no, my son has died, to say that I expected that, people think I'm cold and heartless and more weird than usual. But I do expect any one of you to die at any time. So if someone says, oh, someone hasn't come here today for the talk, and you go to their room and they're dead. And I say, yeah, I expected that. They take me away. The world is just so stupid. Oh, they died, they're too young to die. Too young to die? That's not in the contract when you're born. So, you get this wonderful insight of wisdom. Just, if you die young, doesn't matter, you have another chance. You know, it's not many, many lives, so what's the big deal? You just have another go next time. So what is your happiness anyway? Sometimes, if you really know what happiness is, then nothing phases you. Nothing can upset you. Something happens, and say, I expected that. You go and see a doctor and said, oh, you've got cancer, it's terminal. So that's good. That means I've avoided old age. I've avoided the old age home. Have you ever been in the old people's home? So why don't you die young instead? Have good quality. So sometimes, why are we afraid of these things? The insight challenges to the core of what we're doing. And so obviously you try to do your very best, but if it happens to die, lived a good life, wonderful, great concert. So, the insights here is seeing things in a different way and being courageous enough to admit that sometimes the way the world thinks things, the attachments they get, we're expected to grieve. A lot of grief is just that living up to the expectations pushed on us by our culture. When I was in Thailand for the first 9 years, northeast Thailand, it was indigenous in the sense they hadn't seen any Westerners. I remember going on arms round to one village. I was the first even white person, Caucasian, they'd ever seen. There was no TVs, I don't know if it's even radios, maybe a radio. But when I came on arms round, not just a Caucasian, but a monk too. The people who are putting food in my bowl are supposed to never look at the person, the monk. They're supposed to look in the bowl. and they couldn't help themselves. And most of the rice fell outside my bowl. The dogs had a good meal that day. Well, I didn't get much. So it was a place where no Westerners hadn't been. And so they had their old Buddhist culture. And they never cried at funerals. That was quite shocking me. It was even when they died young, tragically. You never saw tears. They weren't suppressing it. They didn't know how to suppress things. They were just accepted life and death. Much more insightful. But anyway, so that after a while, they were pretty much happy, the land of smiles. They really, really were smiling. Didn't have very much, except their smiles and their families and their happiness. But when you start to meditate, you realize the happiness goes to a different level. Secret of happiness. How to be happy. What a great insight that is. And how can you get those insights? You can't just figure them out with philosophy. You actually do it. You practice and see what happens. And that's one of the reasons why this place fills up too quickly. One lady from Sydney some years ago, she came here, she said, really high-pressure work. And she told me, the way she said it, she had to beg and grovel from her boss to be able to take, you know, a week off to come on a retreat. And it was really hard, but eventually the boss gave in and gave her the week off. So she'd come on a retreat here. As usual, the first few days, really tired. Next couple of days, middle of the retreat, get her energy going. End of the retreat, she was really going well. Had some nice meditation. Okay, you know, that's, you know, self-assessed. She said, oh, I really did some nice meditation. But what happened when she went to work on Monday after the retreat? She quickly sent an email to me. She said, when I turned up at the office, my boss took one look at me, and this is what he said. My boss told me, I don't know what drugs they're giving you in Jhana Grove in Perth, but please bring me back some next time. She was happy. And the boss saw that immediately. And you can see, happy? Where did you go? Don't know drugs here. And start explaining what we did. Well, I got up at 5 o'clock every morning and we did chanting at 6. You got up that time on your holidays. And, you know, what did you eat? Well, we had some breakfast and lunch. And what did you have for dinner? Nothing. Don't give you any dinner there. Even in prison, they give you 3 meals a day. And what did you do? Did you, you know, watch some, did you have parties in the evening? Or do you play golf? Do you go shopping? What did you do there? Just nothing, sat on my bum for 9 days. That's all. In the world, to think this is happiness, to think that you spend your holidays coming here, when you don't have much free time, people think you're crazy. But you refute their judgment of you with your smile, which is real. Happiness. What is the source, the cause of happiness? And it's not going all over the world and seeing these sights. It's not going to 5-star hotels, 6-star. This is much more than a 6-star hotel. You just go, and if it's a nice warm evening, one evening and clear, you go and lay down on the stupa and you see this is a 1,000,000-star hotel. You see all the Milky Way above you. And so that's why we call this a 1,000,000-star hotel. And it's gorgeous. So sometimes, what is happiness? That great insight, and you're experiencing this for yourself. And then, just the deeper insights. You know, what is your mind? People can philosophize about that, but you actually do the experiment and find out for yourself. So, I said I was going to tell this story in one of the interviews. The tadpole and the frog. Did I say that already? No? No. Tadpole and the Frog simile. Once upon a time, are you sitting comfortably? There was a little tadpole, and she lived in a meditation retreat center pond, and she was a very smart little tadpole. So she went to school, she did very well in her O levels and A levels, or the year 12s over here. So much so that she got a place in university in chemistry, which was what she really liked. And she eventually did a PhD on water. She became an expert hydrologist. And at the same time, because it was a retreat center, there was visiting Abhidharma teachers, and little tadpole also learned the Abhidharma about the nature of water. She was an expert on all aspects of water. But even though she wrote very famous books on water, how can a tadpole ever know the nature of water? No more than a fish can. Because a fish was born in water, lived all its life in water. How can you know what a water is? It's all theory. But one day, the difference between a tadpole and a fish is that one day, the little tadpole grows appendages. Doesn't know what they are at first. But then she finds little legs and arms appear. And she doesn't know how to use them. But one day, just messing around, playing around, little tadpole, now become a frog, jumps. And where it lands is where it's never been before. Dry land. This is weird. This is nothing like its experience before. It's really hard to actually understand what this is. It's scary at first, and she wants to jump straight back in, as most people do. But eventually, she comes outside, stands on dry land, and at last she realizes, this is what water actually is. That strange stuff which is no longer here. You can only know what water is when it's disappeared. Now, you can understand why we talk about the insight born of stillness. When things start to vanish, then you can understand what they really are. What vanishes? Time vanishes. No past, no future, you're in this moment. Timeless. Time has vanished for you. That's why sometimes you sit here, and you sit here, you're perfect, you're not asleep, you're aware, and, hey, it can't be the right time, come on. That's 2 hours have gone past. No way. And it has. Sitting here really, really peaceful, and time has just vanished for you. Now you have an idea of what time is, once it's gone. What was that lovely story about this, he's a Vietnamese monk. Ajahn Sujato knows his name, but he probably won't say, because when monks do weird stuff, we'd usually keep it quiet. Once they're dead, then we let them know. So they don't get sort of proud and just, come on, do it again for us. So this monk, it's a 9-day retreat over in Sydney somewhere. And they started a retreat, as here, you have your orientation, and this retreat, half an hour meditation, and then the talk for the beginning of the retreat. So all came in there, into the hall, in some place in Sydney. The monk was sitting up in front, meditating for half an hour, and this talk was supposed to start, but the monk carried on meditating. Now, 8:30, he's still sitting quietly. 9 o'clock, he still hadn't moved. And, say people in Australia, if they may be in Vietnam, they may have waited a bit longer, but it came to 9 o'clock, no talk, so they went to bed. They didn't need any bell, they just went. And so they got up in the morning, they had the schedule, they came up in the morning, he was still meditating, they hadn't moved, chanting, still sitting there, breakfast time, still sitting there, lunch time, still hadn't moved, 8 days he sat there, not moving, not drinking, not eating, not going to the toilet, just like a Buddha statue. Didn't move at all. And after 8 days, he sort of opened his eyes and said, sorry, I just, you know, got into this beautiful deep meditation, timeless. Time had no meaning, so now he's out. And he said, sorry, I should have given you some talks. And I said, no, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. To see that a monk can still do that, it was so inspiring. You know, all the talks and talks and talks, but actually to see that right in front of you, a monk sitting without moving for 8 days, that was really cool. But timeless. If you do that and think, that's 1 hour, that's 1 day gone, I've got another 7 days to go, that becomes impossible. But if those things do happen, it's just, you just go into a deep stillness and then open your eyes, time has no meaning. So time disappears, now you can understand what time is. Time is the result of wanting. Craving creates time. Stop the wanting, the craving, and time vanishes. Do you believe me? Experiment, try it out, see if it works. So you get real nice insights. The next thing is just, you know, the thinking stops. And it's amazing how many people still assume that you can answer problems through thinking. You can get to the essence of a problem and solve it just by thought. And people still believe that. Even though it just creates so many headaches, never really gets to the heart of the problem. Does thinking really solve problems? In your life, how many problems have you really got into and solved and finished with through thoughts? We should be get wise enough now. That's the only thing we've been taught. I was really screwed up when I was at school. I'm sure this happened to me, that my teachers said, what do you think about that, Peter? That's my lay name. And I said, nothing. And they called me stupid. I could have been enlightened far quicker. But I was encouraged to keep thinking and thinking and thinking. Because we think, if you don't think, you're stupid. But in meditation, if you don't think, yeah, you're wise. So, what we do, we learn just the beauty, and you can stop thinking, you can be silent. And when I did that sort of little exercise of listening to the pauses, you know, for some people that was the first time they recognized what silence was. They felt it, and they realized it's not that hard to not think, be silent, and it was beautiful. So, you get insight of what silence is. And then when you get really deep, your body vanishes. Yay! And people say, well, again, people get afraid. If I'm not watching my body, who is? You know, I might get my wallets rifled, get my credit card out, and just go, and by the time I come out of meditation, all my funds have been milked and no money left in my accounts. Or whatever it is, people get so afraid. I'm not afraid of that because I have no money. You can rifle everything. But once these things start to disappear, it's amazing, our body's gone. And this is one of the reasons why when your body goes, it's so much more peaceful and happy and joyful. You're free from aching body. Always itchy, always, you know, I've got an itchy nose right now. I just would love to get in there and just really scratch it. But there's a camera on me. But the body is, you know, you do it once, you have to do it again afterwards. And so it's just endless. There's always something which, you know, say itched or scratched or something. Oh my goodness. Anyway, so that when we learn how to let things go, and the body disappears, we have our insight. Something's disappeared, now we understand what this body is. When the Buddha says it's suffering, some of the people, oh, get a life, monks. Why did he go? Have you ever listened to Beethoven's The Fifth by the Berlin Philharmonic? One of the greatest pieces of music. You say, wow. But that is so much Gomayang compared to silence. People say, can't understand that. Or they have to see the birth of your first child, to be there. Magic moments. But to see everything vanish and disappear, that's even more magic. So there's happiness and blisses which only tadpoles who are now frogs can really appreciate. The absence of things rather than the accumulation of more things. When things disappear rather than there's more stuff which you have to look after and care for, which you have to be responsible for. Little by little, you experience the ending of things, the disappearance of things, of being bliss. And then you go into these jhana realms. Woo, blow you away, the bliss of them. Happiness, you ain't seen nothing yet. You think sometimes in the first jhana, there can't be anything more than that. That's the ultimate. That's why many people, if they haven't got a good teacher, they believe that's union with God. Nothing can be higher than that. Absolute bliss, oneness, pure love, nothing missing. I think there can't be more than that. And then something vanishes. And there is deeper stuff. Weird things. The first time you get into a deep meditation, a jhana, you say, wow. And you can't expect and understand there's something more. More bliss. Bliss upon bliss upon bliss. Are there any mathematicians here? Remember the infinity. I always thought infinity meant the highest number. But then, it's very easy proof. There's numbers infinitely bigger than infinity. And there's other numbers infinitely bigger than the infinitely bigger than infinity. So they have this whole series. Infinity is alpha null, alpha one, alpha two, alpha three, and it keeps on going on to infinity. Numbers infinitely bigger than infinity. At first I thought, ah, no way. But it's true. I think when you first get into this infinite bliss of the first jhana, you think nothing could be a bit bigger than that. But then it is. Is it like the little frog gets other little legs and goes out of the first jhana to the second jhana? Things have just vanished again. More happiness. That's why it's ever not attaining more, not getting more, but things vanishing. More and more bliss. More and more joy, more and more ecstasy. Not the tablets, but the disappearing state. So this is where we get insights into the nature of bliss. And what's missing? And I said this before, it really shocks you. I don't expect you to agree with me. In fact, if you did agree with me, you're just making it up. That the will vanishing, totally gone. Then that's why you stay for such a long time in these states. There's no exit button. The will is just not there. Nothing you can do, no choice. You're stuck. Having a great time, very happy to be stuck. Not wanting to go. We can't want. The will has vanished. You say, well, that's weird. But the point is, what it does for you, it's an insight. Now the will has vanished, now you know what it is. You know, before you always think it's your friend, it's part of you, one of the most intimate parts of who you take yourself to be. And all you need to do is to make the will a bit smarter, then you'll be fine. When you actually see it for what it is, it can't be made so. It's a problem. It's the thing which causes you the trouble. That's why in Pali, you may call it Sankara, and I think it was in the Theragata where they said, that is the house builder. House builder, you have been seen. You're not going to create any more buildings for me. No more rebirth. Can you understand that, accept that? If you can, it's only because you have trust in me, because you've known me for such a long time. But it's only a trusting acceptance. In the end of these jhanas, the biggest kick in your backside ever. We really see that there is no will. Or what you took to be the will has nothing to do with you. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So that's how this insight happens. I'll carry on later on. I'm sure I'll get lots of questions on that. Oh, just one little announcement. Today is a full moon day. So this afternoon, the monks, we have a little ceremony over in the hall in Bodhinyana. So I had to cut the last two interview sessions off for this afternoon because I had to leave about 4:15. And also for those of you who have gone over to Bodhinyana, you're most welcome to meditate there, but not this afternoon because the monks will be doing some stuff there. Finished in the evening. So anyway, so we'll be back for the talk in the evening, the question and answer. But of course, there will be the interviews this morning until 4:10. Very good. Okay, have a nice time. If you want to. Please disappear. Please get lost.